Morning, everyone. I thought I'd dress up for you guys today. Don't expect it every day. So where we left off, so we're doing this nearly free electron model where electrons move in a periodic potential described by a wave vector Q, big Q. And I guess we looked at the effect of that potential on states near the bottom of the band at the end of the last lecture. And I argued that the effect of the potential, which basically scatters an electron from an initial state into a state with wave vector momentum plus or minus Q from that state, that the effect of the states on the bottom of the band would to shift them down slightly and to increase the effective mass. Anyway, did you?
What's on your axis?
This is the energy, and this is the wave vector. Let's call it Q. It's a one-dimensional problem. Okay, and so this is energy. This is actually the free particle energy. Okay, then the M is the free particle mass. Okay, so we did that using second order perturbation theory because that potential scatters an electron from a state here up to a state here or up to a state over here, and those are far apart in energy. And then I said, yeah, but what happens, what is the effect of the periodic potential on states in this region here, which are actually can be quite close, or arbitrarily close in energy, because of course Q and minus Q are degenerate. Okay, so in that case, you use degenerate perturbation theory, which amounts to diagonalizing in the space of the states that are mixed, and so your little Hamiltonian for some value of wave vector looks like this. H bar squared over 2m, say, I say, well, it's, okay, k plus q over 2 squared and vq and v minus q and h bar squared over 2m. Minus q over 2 plus k squared. You want to diagonalize that matrix. Okay, and that's really easy to do, of course. And the eigenvalues, let's call them of k, will be I guess there's a tiny bit of algebra here, which I won't write. Of course, you can check my algebra for mistakes, which often can easily happen.
Just reminding us, what's the procedure in degenerate perturbation theory?
You just diagonalize within the subspace of the degenerate states that are connected by the perturbation.
Diagonalize the Hamiltonian?
Just that piece of it that involves the degenerate states. Because the point is that the effect of the perturbation on degenerate states, it's non-perturbative, if you like, but basically it splits them by an amount proportional to the size of the perturbation. Okay, whereas in second order, you know, for states that are widely separated in energy but connected by a perturbation, then they're just shifted. They repel each other by an amount that goes like the perturbation squared divided by the energy difference. That's a non-degenerate perturbation. So degenerate perturbation theory, which is where, you know, much of the interesting physics in nature is. in degenerate, you know, what happens when you have a very highly degenerate manifold and then you introduce some perturbation that splits that degeneracy, because, you know, if you like, anything can happen. I mean, the classic example is the two-dimensional electron gas in a magnetic field, okay, which we could have done as part of this module, but probably won't. But in the case of the electrons in a strong magnetic field, you start out with your band like that in two dimensions, and it immediately splits up into a bunch of delta functions. And the degeneracy, the number of states which go into each delta function, which is a lambda level, is exactly proportional to the strength of the magnetic field that you apply. So what happens is you crank up the field. This is just for electrons in two dimensions now. When you crank up the field, you have these, you start out with a continuous spectrum like this. It immediately breaks up into a bunch of tiny, closely spaced delta functions, which get further and further apart and more degenerate, because all the states are going into each one. And so then, in high field, you've got massively degenerate energy levels. And the question is, then, what happens if you introduce any perturbation? Okay. Well, in the case of the quantum Hall effect, the perturbation that you introduce is the first perturbation that comes in typically is depends on your system, but it's randomness, the random potential of the system, which mixes those states up and actually localizes almost all of them, but not the one in the middle of each delta function. And in the case of very high magnetic fields and very clean samples, then it's the Coulomb interaction between the electrons that gives you this novel state that Bob Laughlin invented, wrote down, which has fractionally charged quasiparticles. So the point is, degenerate perturbation theory is a really neat business, but this is the most trivial example, two states. Okay. But it is significant that you can see what happens is that so the way that I've cooked this up, k equals 0 corresponds to the states, the degenerate states at plus or minus q over 2. And you can see what happens when that little k is 0, that you basically, one state goes up by absolute value of v, and one state goes down, and you get a gap. Okay, so that's that. Nothing more to say about that. Oh, except that if you look at this for k over q much less than vq over h bar squared q squared over 2m. And do I mean to square this? I probably should have this. No, I think I have it right. That's right, yeah. OK. You can expand this out. So the point is that this q is big. This q can be made arbitrarily small if you're looking at the states arbitrarily close to q over 2, or plus or minus q over 2. And so you can always make this term small compared to this one. And in that case, then, let's call it this. I guess this should be 8m or something like that. Yeah. I just did. I mean, you know, there might be some factors of two wrong in this. Maybe not. You should check it. But what does this mean? Okay. So what it means is the following. That if you look around here, and you look around here, that it's a little bit hard to draw this properly. This is 2VQ. There's a little gap, assuming that the scattering potential is weak. There's a little gap. And these things curve up. So if you like, if you just looked at the states right around, say, this upper piece, it looks like a particle with a very light mass. Right? It's, there's a large curvature. The thing's curving up. Looks like a light particle. Okay, and then it goes off and looks like the regular thing. Okay, so it's actually a little bit singular when you take the potential to zero, because when you take the potential to zero, these things are going to go into a straight line that goes right through. Yeah.
A light particle,
if just think in terms of like effective masses for free particles, like if this m is very small, then this thing is going, the coefficient of q squared is large. So if you think of this thing starting off, it's going up quickly. Okay, as opposed to down here, say, where it's going up slowly. You see the
difference? So the other one is lighter?
Yeah, right around that point there, it's like you have a light particle, okay? But only very close. Actually, I guess the homework problem that you have is the extreme limit of this, because the graphene spectrum is like a Dirac spectrum, and the mass is zero, okay? So this is a little bit like that, except with a little gap in it, okay? So in particle physics, I guess they often talk about the mass of the particle being some kind of a gap, and that's because of mc squared. Whereas we often think of the dynamics of the particle, the coefficient of k squared is 1 over a mass. Okay, and then there's the connection. Actually, in this case here, it works out nicely with the size of, I guess it's probably some generic principle of nature. The size of the gap is related to the size of the mass in a way that makes sense. Small gap, small mass. Okay. Then you could go ahead and do this trick with all the higher bands, because when you go out to 3q over 2 or 3q over 2 and minus 3q over 2, those are related by 3 reciprocal lattice vectors, and q and minus q are related by, you can sort of go off in higher order perturbation theory, I guess. Or maybe not. Well, it depends. Okay, but anyway, for a general periodic potential, you'll have a series of gaps in the spectrum. And basically, because of the periodic potential, momentum in the continuous sense is no longer a good quantum number. It's only modulo reciprocal lattice vectors. And the wave vector, and states are labeled by the wave vector in the Brillouin zone. So you can draw this picture in a different way, where you fold it back. So here's another attempt at artwork. Let's do it like this. So this is q over 2, and this is minus q over 2. It's not so good already. Go a little further out. So basically, you've got this band that starts off like this and goes flat here. And then there's another band which you can fold this thing back in towards the center of the zone. and you get something that looks like this. So these are the states between q and minus q, q over 2 and minus q over 2, and these are the states out in the next range. So you could label these bands, call them bands, by the wave vector, successively larger, higher bands will correspond to successively larger wave vectors of the states that they came from. Okay, as you fold everything back into the first Brouwer zone.
So is the band then a quantum number?
Yeah. So the band is a quantum. The band index is a quantum number. So you started out in free space, and the only quantum number was the wave vector. You put the thing in a periodic potential, and now you have two quantum numbers. You have where you are in the first Brouwer zone, and then which band you're in. Okay. So that's the way to think of things that are nearly free with a weak periodic potential. But the point is that having bands, which do look like this, you know, with go flat at the zone boundary and have gaps separating bands, is totally generic for electrons in a periodic potential. You don't have to start off with weak perturbations away from nearly free system. Let me just see what I wanted to tell you here. Oh, okay. This also accounts for, of course, properties of solids that if you have you fill these bands with electrons, and if you fill a band partially, then the electrons can move around easily because there are unoccupied states. So say you put in this number of electrons, okay? There's only one per state, except for spin. And then you say, okay, let's apply some perturbation to this system, like an external electric field. You see that the state can adjust to a perturbation like that, or a time-dependent field, very easily, because there are empty states up here that are infinitesimally close to occupied states here. So any perturbation, say a time-dependent perturbation, inhomogeneous thing, can cause transitions at infinitesimal cost in energy, rearrange things, and then the electrons will respond in some way. So this type of thing, which is a metal is basically a solid that has a Fermi surface. In this one-dimensional case, the Fermi surface consists only of two points. But in two dimensions, it's some kind of closed line. And in three dimensions, it's surfaces that enclose volume. A metal, as I said, is a solid that has a Fermi surface. And it can respond. On the other hand, if you were to fill up all these states and then just apply some perturbation to your electrons, it's hard for them to do anything. Because the only thing that can happen is if an electron down here were to move to a state, say, up here, and there's a finite amount of energy required to do that. It's not something you can do infinitesimally easily. And so systems like this, where all the states are filled up to a gap, are insulators. Okay. The catch is, of course, it depends how big the gap is, because there are these other things called semiconductors, which are sort of, what do they call it? It's like the anthropic principle, right? It's a semiconductor because the gap is comparable to the temperature of the world in which we live. So a semiconductor is just an insulator with a smaller gap. Okay. So that's right. But the other point that I would make is that, yeah. I'm sorry, where? This guy here? No, I must have left off a term. Yeah, just a second. Yes, this is very bad. Okay, let's see, plus or minus. Okay, so I did this wrong. Yeah, okay, so, yeah, let me, sorry. Okay, so what is this thing? The energy here is equal to the unperturbed energy, which is h bar squared q squared over 8m, plus or minus the magnitude of the potential, so states above are moved up by vq and below are moved down by vq, that's this, okay? And then there's the q squared term. So where this thing goes, and this is where the perturbation theory comes in, because this formula is only valid right in this narrow range. And that curvature is essentially 1 plus or minus this big number, OK? I encourage you just to just do this yourself. Okay, so basically, this guy has an upward curvature, and this one has a downward curvature. That's a big curvature or a small mass. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I just did I get this right now? Yeah. Yeah. Now I've got it right. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. My notes. That's in my notes. I had Q. Okay. Yeah, Alex.
You said the small cap was the mass. And so,
right? No, I said what I said, the small gap is due to the periodic potential. Okay? The size of the gap is VQ, and the effective mass goes like 1 over VQ. This is a renormalization of 1 over m. That's basically what this is. OK? Does that make sense? Sorry, it's a little sloppy, but yeah.
So if you look at a periodic table, how can we know which ones are metals and which ones will be insulators? Can we use this?
Yeah, so, okay, so first of all, there's a lot of different kinds of metals, some of which are like this nearly free electron. So the ones that are like this probably have unfilled, Dennis, listen to this, tell me whether this makes sense, unfilled S shells, you know, big orbitals out there that are going to overlap a lot and give you big bands, big wide bands. Those are the ones that are free electron-like. So there's two things that you need. Yeah, S, but you know, it might be 3S or 4S, okay, if you like. Okay? And they should, so there's two things you need. You need the conduction electrons to be in these big spherically symmetric orbitals, and you need them to be partially filled. Okay? Now, the partial filling can come about in different ways. Normally, you'd say odd number of electrons. But sometimes, because of a complicated band structure and band overlaps, you could have partially filled bands that are overlapping, and so you end up with. OK, but the opposite case is where the bands that are, the electrons that are delocalized are in, say, D orbitals or something like that that are highly directional, and maybe they're screened by some filled S. There's weird things that happen in the periodic table, you know, the missing electrons don't necessarily come out of the state with the highest quantum number. And so, you know, you can have these orbitals that are highly directed and maybe weakly overlapping, and you can get very narrow bands and still be metals, depending on exactly how the filling works out. The rule is that if there are partially filled bands, then it's a metal. Okay, that's the rule. Okay.
And why are the bands the S shells?
No, they're not always. Most of the time, they're not, actually. There's lots of transition metals where there's Ds and so forth. But the question is which, my interpretation of your question is, which kind of atoms do you look at that will be well described by a nearly free electron model? Okay, and that's why I was saying S. And that's probably not a universal rule. I mean, as soon as you start looking, you probably find exceptions. Okay, but I mean, there are, you know, like alkali metals. Okay, I guess they're fairly free electron line.
I think
the alkalis, horrible.
I should just mention
that the science of determining the band structure is about science.
Is
a very large field.
Yeah.
And strictly speaking, this is, from my point of view, quite a boring field, but you can find all sorts of possible band structures. So you can have metals, insulators, semi-metals, and so forth. But anyway.
Yes. And Dennis is exactly right about that. However, as interesting systems come along and exhibit interesting phenomena, what you find is that the first thing that you do is you figure out what the band structure would be or should be. Okay. Now, sometimes, of course, then you find out it isn't like that, and that might be some part of the interest. It's a little bit like practically any problem. You know, we talked about mean field theory, and we'll talk about it some more. And someone, maybe it was Marius, pointed out that mean field theory is almost always wrong in less than four dimensions and gets worse as you go to lower dimension. But nevertheless, whenever you start with a new problem, and I don't think this is just in condensed matter physics, I think it's in practically every field, the first thing you do is the mean field theory for that problem. Because even though it gives you the wrong answer, it gives you physical insight into what's going on. Okay, so yeah, this is actually really, really boring stuff. So let's move on. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was the opposite limit, which is called the tight binding limit. And then we'll be finished with band structure. And here the point is simply that if you take a lot of atoms with partially filled shells and put them together, but very far apart, the energy of an electron being on any one of those atoms is the same. So you have a very highly degenerate set of bands. But as you move them closer together, their wave functions on the different atoms start to overlap. And those highly degenerate states split out into a band, okay? And so those narrow bands are called tight binding bands, and so the Hamiltonian for something like this would be say E naught. That's the atomic level. So there you have electrons in degenerate. Highly degenerate states. And then there's always this minus sign that's put in, which I guess you'll derive maybe this afternoon.
This minus, yeah, but there was a minus sign.
Yeah. Okay, now, so now I'm using some notation that is common. So basically, this term here is a term that hops an electron from site I onto a neighboring site I plus delta. Okay, and that looks like this. If you imagine that you've got a site I, And say you're working with a square lattice in two dimensions, then this would be the site I plus x, this would be the site I minus x, and this would be the site I minus y, this would be the site I plus y. And there should be really, this is a vector r sub I or something like that. Okay. And you should note that if you look at this, it looks like you're only hopping from I to I plus delta. So it looks like you're always going out. Okay. However, when you change I to the next site, then you have things going the other way. So this sum represents all possible hopping between nearest neighbor sites correctly. Yeah?
Well, it depends, you see, because it, you could have, say, a smaller probability of hopping to a second neighbor,
or third neighbors, or whatever you want. And in fact, you know, you introduce more and more physics as you do that. So for instance, this is like the simplest model for a square lattice, where you just have nearest neighbor hopping. If you work on high-temperature superconductors, which just have to, where the electrons or the holes, whatever they are, move in planes, which are on a square lattice, you introduce second neighbor hopping, and that changes the band structure. But we'll show you what the band structure is for this case. So then you let you do the usual thing. So you let C dagger I sigma equal 1 over root n sum over k and sigma k. Sorry. Oh, wow. How could I do that? C dagger k sigma e to the I k dot. Here's where I break down and use a complete notation, where k is in the Brillouin zone. Okay. And again, so right away you can see the counting works out, because we started out with n degenerate states corresponding to the n atoms in the crystal. And we end up with being able to create or destroy electrons in n states in the Brillouin zone, n values of k in the Brillouin zone. So this is a unitary transformation. And you put that into your Hamiltonian. I guess I'll do this because it might actually be useful for you. Just a second, let me make sure I got this right. E naught e to the I k minus k prime dot r I. Sorry, am I okay here so far? Minus t sum over delta e to the I k r I plus, now I'll just call it a little vector delta, e to the minus I k prime dot r I times c dagger k sigma c k prime sigma. So what did I do? I used this twice, once for each of the operators. And the difference here is that both of the operators are at ri. So I just get k minus k prime dot ri. Whereas in this case, one of the operators is at I plus delta. So I get e to the I k ri plus delta from this guy, and then k prime dot ri from this one. And then I'm going to use the fact that sum over I e to the I k minus k prime dot ri is equal to n times the Kronecker delta of k and k prime. Yes?
There should be the emission conjugate term added.
No, that was the point. So you think that there should be the Hermitian conjugate term added here?
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, because when you change I to the next one, in other words, there's a sum over I. So this has all the things that are hopping off of I, and the next terms from around it have the terms that are hopping back on, the terms hopping back on I. But in the homework problem, I think you have to give careful thought to this for graphing, or you might get into trouble. Because I think what Dennis is saying is a little bit of a trap in graphing. We haven't talked about lattices with more than one atom per unit cell, which graphene is. But you can learn about, teach yourself about that. OK. So what happens here? So k prime equals k. The n disappears. And what we need is to know what is the minus t sum over I e to the I k dot delta. That's what you need after you get rid of, after you do the sum over I. And this thing here, so I'm just now doing this for the square, just to make life simple. And so this is just equal to minus 2t cos kx plus cos ky. So that's the with unit lattice constant. I've taken the lattice constant to be 1. So cos kx plus cos ky is the dispersion relation. So let me just write down the answer here. So h is equal to sum over k and sigma epsilon of k, C dagger k sigma C k sigma, where epsilon of k is equal to E naught minus 2t cos kx plus cos ky. So now, what is that like, that cos kx plus cos ky? Well, if k is small, will be something like E naught minus 4t times kx squared plus ky squared. So what does this band look like, by the way? So it's hard to draw this because it's in two dimensions. But if you go along one direction, it looks like a cosine that starts off at minus 4. Okay. So basically, in your tight binding band, near k equals 0, it looks like a free particle with effective mass something 1 over m star proportional to t. So this goes, this is like where, yeah, you can see. On the other hand, these are cosines, so they're not quadratic forever. So they go through an inflection. And there's a bottom of the band, and there's a top of the band. Okay. So but in any case, that's what it's like. So I'd just like to say one other thing about tight binding. I didn't have to start with one orbital per site. I could have started with several orbitals per site. Say, for instance, when you have electrons in d levels, you might have several degenerate orbitals, which are different in character because they point in different directions. And the overlap, as you bring those atoms together, between states in different orbitals will be non-trivial. You can also have more than one atom in a unit cell, for instance. So if you have a square lattice, instead of just having atoms here, you might have atoms, I don't know, here. Well, actually, it's more interesting if you don't. You might have atoms like here. Well, I don't know. It's hard to do this because you might have two different kinds of atoms in a unit cell, okay? And you repeat it. But the point is that you can still write down a tight binding Hamiltonian that involves hopping between the different atoms. And in general, you can diagonalize that using the translational symmetry plus you might end up having a small matrix to diagonalize. Okay, so tight binding, actually, if you ask what tight binding is good for, and you'll see I didn't derive it from any fundamental Hamiltonian. I didn't derive this from the theory of everything Hamiltonian. I just wrote it down. Okay, what tight binding is good for is if, say you know a band structure. Well, first, it's good for trying to guess what a band structure should look like. It's also good if you do a humongous band structure calculation and you get out what you think is like the physical band structure, and then you can actually parameterize it and fit it with tight binding hopping things, and you can sort of model the band structure as a tight binding model and use that for other calculations, calculations involving the response of that complicated band system, the electronic response of that system. Okay, so it's also really good for totally theoretical models, like the Hubbard model. Okay, I mean, there's a lot of really difficult, interesting physics problems where the kinetic energy part is just a tight binding kinetic energy. Okay, so it's an important tool. Yeah.
So the small k means the factorization of the are you changing the E zero value or the thickness E zero value?
No, I think I made a mistake.
There's some normalization of E naught by a constant term.
Yeah, there's a constant term. So, yeah. E naught minus. Okay, so let me just see if I. Let's try this again. So it's for sure E naught minus 4t. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then when you expand the cosine, you get 1 half kx squared and 1 half ky squared. And so that's with minus sign, so that's plus, right? Yeah, plus 1t kx squared plus ky squared. Sorry. Okay. I'm just wondering if I actually had that wrong here. Yeah, I should read my notes. Okay. Okay, so the last thing I want to say is about Fermi surfaces. Say that you have this band structure, and you start adding in electrons up to some chemical potential or Fermi energy. Okay? So if you look in the space of kx and ky, what does the Fermi surface look like? So the Fermi surface, I think I must have said this before, is the surface of highest surface in K space of the highest occupied states. It divides the occupied states at t equals 0 from the unoccupied states at t equals 0. So if you say, well, I'm only going to put in a few electrons, then only the lowest energy states are going to be occupied, and the dispersion looks like k squared, kx squared plus ky squared. So here's a Fermi surface for EF much less than 4t, say. Why do I say 4t? It's because the distance from the smallest value to the largest value of this thing is, oh no, it's 8t actually, isn't it? 1, 2, 4, it's 8. Cos kx plus cos ky is 0 is minus 4t. So, well, anyway, let's not do that then. So if the Fermi energy is small, you have a circle. Here's the zone boundary. So what happens if the okay, so if the Fermi energy is such that it goes right through the middle of the band, in other words, through cos kx plus cos ky equals 0, then the Fermi surface looks like this. So this is EF equals 0 for, let's write it, epsilon of k is minus 2t cos kx plus cos ky. And that's because everywhere along these lines, cos kx plus cos ky adds up to 0. So you actually get a square Fermi surface that divides half the states which are filled from half the states which are empty. So what happens if EF is larger than 0? Then what happens is you start getting you get a Fermi surface that looks like this. Around the corners of the Brillouin zone. And that basically means that your empty states are near the top of the band, which is at these points. Pi pi is, yeah. So basically, as you add electrons to the system, you start off with a little circle, you go to a square, and then you start. So these are holes now. The states in here are holes. Okay, so you can actually turn your everything upside down and think of it as the holes that are the particles. Okay. Yeah. This is the hub. It's the hub. It's the coefficient of it's the hub. So it's the original Hamiltonian. Okay. Okay, so the next topic is Hartree-Fock, which we're not going to be able to get very far with today. Let me just write down the question, and then we'll do the answer tomorrow. Okay. Okay, so the problem that we want to address is the case where the Hamiltonian is equal to, as a kinetic energy term, plus an interaction term. And the interaction term I apologize here. Let's write it this way. It doesn't matter, but it's alpha, actually. These are the spins, yeah. Yeah. And the interaction Hamiltonian looks like this. Okay, so now I see. Okay, I see why I started the other way. But yeah, I should have started with this. Okay, so I'm going to start out by writing the interaction in position space so that you can understand that there is some kind of potential acting between atoms on different sites. You can also understand that these things here, these states, which are linear combinations, are going to be like the tight binding states. This epsilon is going to be like a tight binding wave function. And this potential, if you want a physical interpretation of it, it's some generic potential interaction between electrons on two neighboring atoms, or two atoms separated by this vector. So it's not just, say, the Coulomb interaction, because each of those electrons resides in an atomic orbital. They're sort of spread out, and you're trying to solve the problem of interacting electrons in different orbitals. Okay? But otherwise, this is the generic two-particle interaction. Okay? And then the next thing we want to do is Fourier transform it so that we're working with the same states, and then we want to solve the problem. Okay? And the problem, the way that we're going to solve the problem, of course, because this is the problem, so we can't solve it, but we're going to solve it in mean field theory for fermions, which is called Hartree-Fock, which involves writing down or finding the best possible distribution function or the best possible wave function that corresponds to a product of one particle wave functions. It's your generic, it's exactly what I told you back in the first lecture. We're going to do it for this. Chris, did you?
Is the self-interaction forbidden by the having the annihilation operators written at the end there so that?
Yeah, you guys are smart. tell me, okay? So when does this in section 5.2? And I did it just in my notes, and it turns out we do almost everything exactly the same, except he writes, he orders these things differently, and it seems to me that he has the self term, and it even ends up in the answer, and it doesn't make any difference because it's just a constant term which renormalizes the chemical potential, so it gets thrown away. So if someone wants to think about this a little bit more carefully than I'm able to, I guess the question is, does it matter whether you write it like this or whether you write it the way Wen writes it? Like that. I mean, the answer that I know for sure is that at worst it gives you a constant which doesn't depend on K, which effectively changes the chemical potential. Okay. But, and it hardly changes anything in the derivation, but it's just something that I stumbled on. Okay. So I think that's maybe enough for today. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
The following announcement. So if you may wonder why you put so much in